Dating has nothing to do with trusting God. For me, dating had everything to do with avoiding what I was afraid of, avoiding my insecurities, avoiding my sense of aloneness.
You're listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. On this program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber conclude their discussion on the issue of singleness. On the last program, they focused on romance and infatuation. Today, they take a hard look at the pervasive cultural phenomenon of dating. Is there a point at which we might say dating is unbiblical? Can dating actually be a way of not trusting God, of not growing up, of having a false ownership of another person? Are we going to let our culture dictate how we go about relationships? These are big questions. They must be asked. Here now are Jack and Christine.
In the last 2 weeks, we've been talking about the whole area of singleness. How do people get to know each other of the opposite sex in a responsible and respectful way? Typically, we think about getting to know the other person through the process of dating. Let's start out by defining what dating is and go on from there.
Yeah, I think it's important to get clear what how we're going to use our terms, because otherwise what I'm going to say is going to be very confusing to some people. What I don't mean by dating is getting out your calendar or your appointment book and agreeing to do something together or meet together for some reason. Just setting, socializing together, having fun together, going to a movie together is not necessarily a date in terms of the way that I'm going to be talking about it. What I mean by dating is the kind of cultural phenomenon that at least was prevalent when I was growing up, and I assume still is to some extent, where young men and women would make attachments to one another and would forge some sort of sense of ownership in relationship to one another. Some kind of agree to have some kind of exclusive kind of relationship. And really what it was is a quasi-marital relationship. They would have the same kinds of expectations toward one another that a husband and wife would have toward one another, the same kind of sense of legitimacy to be jealous of the other's time and attention and love and commitment and so on. That's what I mean by dating. And I realize that our culture has changed over the years. Back when I was a very, very young and in college, there were all kinds of degrees of being committed to one another. You were engaged, and below that you were, what, pinned or something like that, and before that
going
something
steady.
Else. And, yeah, going steady. And they had it worked out to a pretty sophisticated system that I never understood. But it's kind of collapsed through the 60s, all that kind of collapsed. But to the extent that we still have the remnants of a system that encouraged people to be married before they got married, or I should say, to play like they were married before they were married, it's that whole mentality that I mean by dating. And
when you say play like, you're not saying just like we were playing around, but we were really acting as though that was the truth.
Right, exactly.
We were serious about it.
Yeah, we were dead serious about it, but we were dead serious about something that we had no right to be serious about, I would argue. And so my contention is dating is just wrong. Dating is unbiblical. Dating is immoral. Dating is an evil institution. But understand what I mean by dating when I say that.
Okay, so in order to make that really clear, let me see if I'm understanding you, and perhaps that will help the listeners also. You're using dating, the word dating, in a very very singular sense. You're saying that the dating that you're disagreeing with, that you think is immoral and very wrong, is when two people who are not married actually act indeed as though they are.
Right.
And they might call that going steady, they might call that being pinned, they might call that whatever the culture calls it today. Maybe they don't have a name for it today. I think, I don't know of any name that is put on it today. But nonetheless, there's this acting as though I am owned by you and you belong to me. And we are very exclusive in our relationship to each other, such that if you go out with somebody else, I'm going to be very, very hurt.
Right.
Or if you talk to somebody else in a particular way, I might be very hurt. In other words, I have a ownership to the way that you're behaving with other people. You're saying that kind of dating is wrong.
Yeah, this may be controversial, but what you've called ownership seems to be something that is actually appropriate in marriage. And for people who followed our series on marriage, hopefully it would make sense why there would be something appropriate about me expecting from my wife that she would be committed to me being the most significant person in her life. That's what we have promised one another in marriage. And because we promised that to one another in marriage, it's appropriate to expect it of one another. So if my wife were all of a sudden showing greater attention to some other man than me, I have every, it's very normal and appropriate, morally appropriate for me to go, what's up? You know, what's going on here? This is not what we promised each other. When that same kind of attitude comes out of me in a non-marriage relationship, in something that we've called going steady or something else, or dating or something else, when that same attitude comes out of me there, I have to ask the question of myself, what gives you the right to think that you have any expectations from her? Where have you made your promises, Jack? And outside the context of those very real, serious promises that we've made to another person that are forever, that are for keeps, that are to the end of my life, I have no right to expect any kind of commitment to me in turn, and any commitment to make me the most special person in her life. But what I see happening, or what I have seen in the history of this country, of this culture, is a series of relationships where that's exactly the attitudes that we take toward one another in that dating relationship, and we feel perfectly justified and all right in doing that because our culture says, oh, you're dating. Oh, you're going together. Oh, you belong to one another right now. And the problem, as I see it, is if commitment is commitment in marriage, if we only belong to someone if they are committed to me to the end of their life, why on earth would we create an institution that says, I belong to you until I decide otherwise? I belong to you until I decide I don't want to belong to you. That goes against the very virtue of what makes marriage marriage. So to have a quasi-marriage that pretends and acts as if we're going to be committed to one another as married people are committed to one another, but we're not going to make it something that's permanent, is I think, that's what I'm calling an evil institution.
Jack and Christine will be back in a moment. First, here's a question. What does it mean to take the Bible seriously? Does it mean that you carry your Bible with you everywhere you go? Well, maybe. Does it mean that you read it every day? Could be. Does it mean that you believe what it teaches is true? Certainly. But how do you know what the Bible really teaches? The staff of the McKinsey Study Center believes that discovering what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible is central to taking the Bible seriously. At the heart of McKinsey is a desire to let the text speak for itself, to understand the Bible the way its authors intended. They believe the truth contained in the Bible offers a radical message for our world. They also believe that studying the Bible is a lost art. However, at McKinsey, studying the Bible is not just an intellectual exercise. It's about learning to see this world and to see ourselves the way God does. It's about coming to terms with our sin and God's wonderful mercy. It's about truly having hope in this fallen world. If you are interested in knowing more, we would like to send you our tape catalog or our free monthly newsletter, News and Views. At the end of the program, we'll tell you how you can get in touch with us. But right now, here again are Jack and Christine.
Jack, before the break, you were making the distinction between being married and having a commitment in marriage and having that be a right and good thing, where I am really committing myself to be loyal to pay most attention to make my spouse most special in my life. And that's a commitment that I've made in marriage and I need to keep, expect of myself, and really expect of my partner. If I'm not doing it, I need to ask myself, you know, what's going on here and to make some changes. And I also can request that, talk about that with my spouse. But when I'm just developing a relationship with another person of the opposite sex, prior to being married, I really am not making that same kind of commitment at all. It seems to me that the kind of commitment that I'm making to a person that I'm in relationship with is a commitment to try to know them, to try and understand them, to try and see who they are as a unique individual. Now, that's part of my marriage commitment, but I think that's the only part of the marriage commitment that overlaps, really, in my relationship with another person while I'm not married, is to really try and to respectfully and with honor try and get to know who they are as a person.
Yeah, exactly. And the difference between marriage and the kind of friendship relationship that there is a sort of commitment to and a sort of loyalty to and so on outside of marriage. The difference, however, is I have not done anything immoral if life and circumstances and my own growth and development means that I drift apart from the other person. If we just sort of mutually drift off in different directions because our interests grow and change in different directions, I haven't done anything immoral. That's just life. People come in and out of relationships, come in and out of greater and greater depth of time spent and attention given and intimacy and so on. And I really think that's okay. I don't think there's anything morally remiss on my part if I'm allowing myself to not see someone as often and not be as much of a friend to them as I was 5 years ago or something like that. But that's exactly what's wrong in a marriage. To allow myself to drift apart from my wife or husband is a violation of my marriage vow. I need to work at not letting that happen. So you're right, there are certainly dimensions of our non-marriages, our friendships, our relationships, both with members of the same sex and of the opposite sex, where the relational aspects of it are very similar to what has to go on in marriage. But there is no commitment. There's no marriage commitment per se.
If we haven't made a quasi-marriage commitment.
Right, exactly, right.
Because as you're talking, you're saying that it's okay if I kind of move in and out of relationships that I'm not married, when I'm not married. But it really is... almost feels like a divorce when I am in a quasi-married relationship and then I kind of decide I just don't want to be with that person anymore. I've called them 7 days of the week. I talk to them on the phone till midnight. I'm going out with them, spending lots of money on them or lots of time or lots of emotional energy, and all of a sudden I decide to drop it.
Yeah, exactly. And I would call it a quasi-divorce. I mean, it's not just like a divorce. It is a kind of divorce. I had a quasi-marriage, now I have a quasi-divorce. And I do think that one of the problems with a pattern of entering into quasi-marriages and then quasi-divorces is that I kind of inure myself to the tragedy of divorce itself. I get used to the idea of divorcing people, and I take that with me into any marriage that I have in the future. Divorce will be a whole lot easier to people who have already been through divorce a lot of times and have decided that, well, you can just kind of steel yourself to it and callous yourself to it, and you can make it happen and get it, go through it.
Right, because I've been practiced at it, actually.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, Jack, when we talk about quasi-marriage relationships, let's define that a little bit better.
Okay.
It could involve a physical component, sexual component. It could involve primarily an emotional component. One could be there, a sexual component, and not much of emotional, or vice versa.
Right, exactly. We'll talk more about this when we get into a series on sexuality itself. What I'm going to propose is that a really biblical theory of sexuality makes no room for any physical involvement outside of and apart from the marriage commitment itself. That sex belongs in marriage and nowhere else. And in a nutshell, that's what I'm going to argue that the Bible teaches. So there really is no business for Christians, single people, to be having a physical relationship with one another, a sexual relationship with one another at all, to any degree. But just because people are not having a physical relationship with one another does not mean that they are not having a quasi-marital relationship. And that's an excellent point. We have to make that clear, that I can have a celibate quasi marital relationship where we are not having sex with each other, but we still have that same expectation of ownership and exclusivity and commitment that is really unjust and wrong and unfair and inappropriate when there are no lifelong promises.
Okay, so at this point we're leaving out the whole area of being sexual in the context of getting to know another person.
Right.
Simply because we're making the bold statement that sexuality just doesn't exist, not sexuality, but sexual demonstration of any kind of physical sexuality toward one another is inappropriate outside of marriage.
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, you did say we're going to talk about this later, but I want to underline that. I can imagine lots of people who are listening are having many, many questions about that statement that we're making. I'm going to agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. But I think it really needs to be looked at closely and carefully, especially in our culture where we just assume a lot of sexual intimacy when we're getting to know each other, or at least some degree of sexual intimacy. So for those people who are maybe crawling out of their seats right now, stay tuned. We'll come back to it in a few weeks because we are going to, I believe, next talk about sexuality in our next several programs.
Okay.
So, Jack, if we're not having a quasi-marital relationship with somebody, if we're not really feeling like I have a right to your time, a right to your loyalty to me, what exactly does it look like to get to know another person of the opposite sex?
Well, I think the key is that sense of entitlement to your time and your affection and your loyalty and so on, because I don't know how anyone could ever communicate a potential interest in someone else as a marriage partner without doing things like calling them often, talking to them often, being with them a lot, communicating through my choices and my behavior that I'm really interested in being with you. I'm really interested in spending time with you. That's not what I'm calling inappropriate.
It's quite a fine line, though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's once again where we've seen a lot of times in this program, it comes down to what's going on inside. What is my deep down inner attitude toward this thing? Do I have a sense of entitlement toward that person? It's one thing for me to keep offering to spend time with someone and them accepting. It's a whole nother thing for me to want to spend time with them. They refuse me and go spend time with someone else, and me being morally, having a sense of moral outrage that they would do that to me, because that's my girlfriend. That's my dating partner. They belong to me. Now, and what I've said, you know, what I'm saying is, although I think things are changing and have changed, not for the better, for the worse, what has been the case in the past is we've had a whole cultural institution that has people agree together for the time being. When I call you up and say, let's go do something, you need to say yes, and don't you dare say yes to anybody else. So we've had a cultural institution that supported us in our sense of entitlement. What I'm saying is our culture is wrong to have that kind of cultural institution. And in any case, we as Christians need to be a part of a counterculture that doesn't practice that institution. We need to have a whole different attitude toward male-female relationships. That attitude, I think, would look, I mean, that, and with that different attitude, our relationships would look like the way I gauge the interest of another person is I take risks. I ask them, do you want to go do this with me? I fully give them the freedom. I recognize that they have the right to say no to me. And if they say no, then I'm faced with the question, what does that mean? Are they just genuinely too busy? Is it just genuinely not a good time for them? Are they telling me that they really are not that interested in me? And I have to sort that out, and I have to figure that out, and I have to come to terms with that.
You use the word taking risks, or the concept of taking risks. And I think that's really at the crux of what we're talking about here, Jack. If I'm, as we said, when we were young, we called it going steady, or now I guess having a dating partner or a boyfriend or girlfriend, there really isn't risk involved. If I can say that I own you or that I'm entitled to you, that risk no longer is there for me. We have decided implicitly or explicitly that we are going together, and that when I call you up and ask you to go out with me, that you're going to do it, and vice versa. When what you're talking about now actually puts a whole lot more risk into the formula.
Yeah.
I'm no longer in a really secure position, in control position anymore. I'm really kind of out of control. I'm really in a place where I have to trust whatever God has for me, yeah. He has for me. And He might not have for me something that feels very good to me or is very comfortable for me at all.
Yeah, I think that's really right. I think that's what... That's the evilness of the dating institution, is that it's a way of trying to manage our lives in a way where we don't have to trust God and we don't have to trust other people. And that's the problem with it. God wants us in a position where we do have to trust Him. I can hear some parents saying, but my 14 or 15 year old daughter, or my 14 or 15 year old son, isn't it terrible to ask someone to do something with you and have them reject you? I mean, that sense of rejection and so on is just terrible. And no 14 or 15 year old should go through that. And my position would be, well, yeah, that's probably true. No 14 or 15 year old should. Maybe they're not mature enough. So maybe they shouldn't be asking yet. We have to be radical in our thinking about this. We mustn't take our cues from our culture. If a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old is emotionally capable of taking that risk, then that's fine. Then let them take the risk. But let's not encourage them to establish an institution that takes the risk out of it. That's just wrong.
It puts us in a place where we really don't have to grow up.
Right.
And that's what life is. That's how God set up life, so that we have to grow up. And while children are children, they're with us as parents, and we are, in a sense, protecting them from some of the bigger blows of life, so that they can grow into being able to handle the big blows. Having been rejected by a person I ask out, it's a pretty big blow.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're saying, is that maybe I'm not ready for that big blow yet, and my parents can kind of help guide me until I'm ready for that on my own.
Okay.
But let's before we started today, we were talking a little bit about, are we going to be talking in this area of getting to know the opposite sex? Are we going to be talking about younger kids? Are we going to be talking about adults in the age of perhaps 20 to however old you are when you're single? And we were choosing the latter. We're really not as much talking about younger kids today. When we do a series on parenting, we'll talk more about that. So we're going to talk really more about the 20-year-old and over, who are out there taking, developing relationships that could work into a marriage relationship at some point.
And presumably are adult enough to be able to take those risks. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So what we're saying, Jack, if we don't have a quasi-marital relationship, then we're really opening ourselves up to the possibility of a lot of pain.
Right. That's true.
Pain in the form of possibly being rejected, possibly not being liked, possibly even maybe never getting married.
Right.
Those are potentials that we don't even like to look at. We don't like to consider that those kinds of things will happen to us. And so I think the whole dating thing has come about so that we can wrap it up, we can close the door, we can make ourselves at least feel secure. The problem is, it really isn't that secure.
Right, it's not. And one of the things that's convenient about dating is that, and again, here's part of the evil of it, if I can't be married, at least can't I be attached to somebody? And I think that's exactly what motivates a lot of relationships. I can't get any man to commit his life to me, but I can get a man to attach himself to me long enough that he can get from me what he wants out of the relationship, sex, emotional intimacy, something or other, until he's done with me. In the meantime, I can feel loved, I can feel cared for, I can feel like someone thinks I'm special. So can I at least have that if I can't have marriage? I think that's the way modern culture, for the most part, thinks about it. But I think that's what you were talking about, that we need to be willing and able to face into pain and deprivation and loneliness and a lack of connection that we desire, because God gave us a desire for that kind of connection. But to be righteous men and women, we need to be willing to be deprived of that need being met if God is not giving us a marriage. But instead, we try to take care of ourselves. We try to get from life, even if it's second best, to get from life what we can get from it and meet our needs our way.
Imagine taking head-on the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Sounds daunting, doesn't it? But that's just what they do at Gutenberg College. Working closely with their teachers, students at Gutenberg read and discuss the great books of our history. But why? Can such an education guarantee one a good job? At Gutenberg College, they believe one's college education should first and foremost be a doorway to a good life. The question then is, what's a good life? The Gutenberg staff believes a good life begins with the pursuit of wisdom rather than mere knowledge. At Gutenberg, the student's character is as important as his intellectual growth. Now, Gutenberg isn't for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you're interested in working personally with your teachers, and if you want to open the doorway to a good life, ask about Gutenberg College. Most of the Gutenberg staff also teach at McKenzie Study Center. At McKenzie, you will find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to everyday experiences. Information will be given at the end of today's program on how you can contact Gutenberg College and McKenzie Study Center. But right now, let's get back to Jack and Christine.
Again, Jack, before the break, we were talking about really the wrongness of being in a quasi-marital relationship, and really what that does is it keeps us from having to trust God. If we're not in a quasi-marital relationship, if we're really just getting to know another person and caring about them in a way that doesn't demand that they be connected to me, then I'm having to take a risk all the time of somebody maybe rejecting me. Although really the risk is there anytime anyway. But at least for the time being, I'm having this sense of need for connectedness filled up. And when I do that, I'm saying I'm not really willing to not have this need filled up. I really must have it filled up, or life isn't going to be okay.
Right.
And as we're talking about these things, people might think, oh, Jack and Christine did it right. And I need to say, at least for myself, I don't know how you did it, but for myself, I did it all wrong. I did it pretty much, very much the opposite of what we're talking about right here. My relationship with my husband was a little bit different because I wasn't interested in him. And so I really didn't have an entitlement to him. I wasn't very connected to him. I didn't feel demanding of him. I really probably did it much more right than any other relationship I did before that. But it wasn't because of anything good or righteous or moral about it. It's just because I simply wasn't interested in him as a person. The way I did do it was the way we're talking about, I think, is really hurtful. I had this very big need, as everybody does, to have myself filled up emotionally. I really felt a lack from my growing up time of feeling like I was very valued, like I really had a family to connect to, that I felt very important to anybody. And early on I found that I could connect myself to a man or a young man in such a way that I could feel very special to him and have somebody right sitting alongside me and being with me on my team. It was really the first time in my life where I felt like I had someone sitting alongside me, really there, really thinking that I'm really pretty great and communicating that to me in a very effusive ways, taking me places, spending money on me, spending a lot of time with me, talking on the phone for hours. Those kind of things really filled me up. They were short-lived. I had a couple of relationships that were quite a bit longer, but still, they weren't commitments that I should have been making, because what they were doing, they were just filling up this part of me that I wanted to be filled up, rather than having a mutual commitment to the other person of respect and value and freedom for them to go their own way. I was claiming them so that I wouldn't have to feel my loneliness.
My experience was very different. I didn't really date at all until... I didn't ever really date at all, I don't think. I'd like to say it was because I was wise and virtuous, but that is not the case. I was just incredibly shy, is the truth of the matter. I probably would have had a youth just like yours, except that I was too scared. I was not willing to take a risk even enough to get into a secure relationship. So there's no merit in my history, but I did not date. And one might argue, therefore, you are rationalizing. You're just trying to give a rational justification for your childhood. And maybe that's the case, but I don't think so. I think I learned a lot. My shyness forced me to ask myself the question, what are you missing? And I watched. I just sat down and watched my friends and their relationships and the attachments and breakups and attachments and breakups and attachments and breakups, and I watched the fallout and I watched the grief and I watched the pain, and I thought, is this right? Can this really be what we should be doing? And then later, in more mature years, as I reflected back on that, it just didn't look like there was any reason for that, that there was anything good that was coming out of that.
I think my experience would have been like yours. I was also very shy, but it was at that time in life, it was the boys that were asking the girls out. The girls never asked the boys out at that time, ever, that I knew of. And so I just got asked out a lot and then got involved in these relationships, just kind of stumbled into it. I'm trying to think of a good example of someone who really did do it well in real life, because you and I are saying we really didn't do it well from our own very, very different experiences. We don't have experience behind what we're talking about today. But I think one person that I know did a really good job, and that was my husband. As I listen to these shows sometimes, my husband listens to them with me, and he says, wow, you really give me a really good resume here. And I do. But this is another one that I really respect about what he did. Early on, we got to know each other, in fact, right after I had ended a quasi-marital relationship of, I think it was over 3 years, maybe 3.5 years, with a boyfriend I'd had throughout college. And I was really devastated by it. And feeling very much alone and very lost, because I had made my whole life around him. I really didn't know very many people in my college, or not really developed many relationships. I wasn't involved in much else besides him. We spent the weekends together. His family really felt like my family. I really didn't have a family. My parents had recently gotten a divorce. We were involved in a ministry together at a church. I was involved with all those high school kids that we were working with. And so when I pulled out of that relationship with him, I was kind of without church, without family, without friends. I was really pretty lost. That's the point at which I met Larry, who's now my husband. And I was at a really vulnerable place, a place that he could have taken advantage of, very, very much so. He... in fact, the first time we got together, he and I, he happened to be with me, and I needed a ride down to my hometown because there was a very big emergency in my home. So he even had an insight into some falling apart places in my life, especially in my family life, that he could have really moved into. But what he did instead was he gave me the freedom to develop and become a person in my own right. And I think it was the first time in my life that somebody didn't demand I be who they wanted me to be, control me so that he felt comfortable, control me so he felt secure. But instead, he encouraged me to become my own person. He asked me important questions. He helped me think about things that were important to me. I remember there was a very important time in my life. We were going up very early on. When we met each other, we were going up in an elevator to meet a person in my family who was very, very sick and who may have died. And he said to me, what do you think you want to say to this person? And what I wanted to say to this person was not good. I was angry at them. I wanted to hurt them. I wanted to use the situation to my advantage. And he didn't tell me not to do that. But he asked me an important question at that point. How do you love this person at this point in your life? And that's the kind of question he kept asking me throughout our relationship. So through my relationship with him, I didn't become dependent in a weak way on him, and him become dependent on a weak way in me. But he was taking risks to allow me to become strong, to become comfortable with myself, to understand what was good, to understand what was right, to understand what is loving. And in doing that, I could well have not chosen him. But I think the reason I ultimately chose him is because I felt so whole with him. Not taken from, not just filling his gaps, but him giving me strength such that I was drawn to him in large part because when I was with him, I no longer felt so lost.
You've really put your finger on one of the things that I think I noticed as I watched my friends in their dating relationships. And that was, unlike some of the marriages that I knew, I never saw a dating relationship as such that was as you described, where the rationale for the relationship was so that I can make you a better person, so that I can commit myself to doing right by you, to doing good to you. It was always, what can I get out of this for me? It was very selfish. Mm-hmm. It was based on self-indulgence from the get-go. And that's true. That's the difference between... Dating really isn't even like marriage in that respect. It's not like what marriage is supposed to be. Because marriage is not about getting what I want from the other person forever. That's not marriage. We've defined it in past programs, and hopefully it's clear that that's not what marriage is all about. It's not selfish and self-oriented. It's a commitment on my part to do right by the other person.
And that's exactly what Larry did for me. He was really committed to doing right by me. And although I wasn't interested at all in him, he was very interested in me and told me pretty early on that he was. And asked me about whether or not I was interested in pursuing getting to know him better and working toward perhaps more of a commitment in the future. And I told him no. That if he wanted a relationship with me, we were just going to be friends. And if he wanted to be committed to being my friend, then that would be great. And that's exactly what he did. He was very much committed to my best interest. He was my friend. And that's what we're really talking about here, Jack. We're talking about, how do I be a friend to another person? A friend is somebody who's looking out for the best interest of the other person, even when it doesn't necessarily give me all that I want. So, Jack, we have about 10 more minutes. Let's talk about, how do I decide who I'm going to marry?
Well, there's a lot of mythology that has developed around deciding to marry another person, and we get really confused by that. Namely, the mythology I think that I have in mind is the notion that there is a right person out there for me.
One person that I have to find.
Yeah, I mean, I think my mental picture growing up was, and I'm not even sure where it came from, but that, you know, I never articulated it in quite this way, but my picture was, before the foundation of the earth, God created me and God created the woman that I was to marry one day, put us down here on the earth, and my job was to find her. And that, you know, when you actually think about that, that's a daunting task. It's a big world.
Very daunting.
He could have put her anywhere.
Should I move to Australia? I remember thinking that. Well, you know, where should I go to school? Did God put this person this place or this place? Should I go to Australia or England or stay in the United States? Or Wisconsin or California?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we take that seriously, it's intimidating. I mean, it's just scary. My view is kind of strange on this, because on the one hand, I do think God has one person in mind for me, because I believe that God is in control of all the details of my life, not only who I marry, but everything else about my life. But I also think that I will necessarily find that woman as well. I mean, God is so much in control of the details of my life, like what decision do I make about where do I go to school, and and what decision do I make about where I'm going to live, and all that leads me to end up marrying the man or woman that God has in mind for me. So it's not my job to find him or her. It's just going to happen. So it doesn't help me at all. It doesn't really make any sense for me to face into the question by asking, is that the man or woman that God wants for me? That question will get me nowhere. The question I have to ask myself is that a person with respect to whom I am willing to make a commitment to be the kind of husband or wife? Let me just speak my perspective. Is that the person with respect to whom I am willing to make a commitment to be the kind of husband that God would want me to be? If I can say yes to that, let me say it in English. I just need to ask myself the question, am I willing to work at doing right by them and being good to them as God would have me to be? Am I willing to commit my life to doing that? If I can say yes to that question, and I can even come close to knowing what I mean by that, I have some kind of concept of what marriage is, and I want to be married to that person, then that is the right person for me.
That actually puts a whole lot of responsibility on me then, rather than on trying to figure out this puzzle.
Exactly.
You know, have I picked up the right piece? Have I done exactly the right thing? Did I go to the University of Wisconsin and that's right? Or should I have gone to this other university and that person would be there? It's taking all that away. It's saying I have the responsibility to ask myself this question. Am I willing to be a loving wife to this person?
Yeah. I remember when I asked Jody to marry me, one of the questions that as I was deciding whether or not I really wanted to do that, one of the questions that kept arising in my mind is, but what if there's somebody else? You know, what if there's someone who would even be better? Someone that I would really, that I would want to be married to even more than I want to be married to Jody. And I think God gave me enough wisdom to recognize, but Jack, if you are willing to make a commitment to her and be faithful to her and do right by her, regardless of whether there's anyone out there who might be better, then that's what marriage is all about. That is, if it becomes irrelevant to you, if you can decide that you are going to make it irrelevant to you, that there might be other people out there who you might have wanted to be married to more, then you're ready to be married to her. Because that's the nature of the marriage relationship, is to decide to exclusively commit myself to this person. And it's not a matter of, is this the best person in the world? I think we've talked about this before. I don't marry who I marry because I ran a contest and she won. There are all kinds of people who didn't know they were competing. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense to think of it in those terms. I made a commitment to her because I made a commitment to her. And it's the commitment that makes it right. It's the commitment that makes that person the right person. So if I'm ready to make that commitment, and I know what I'm doing, you know, I'm not just naive, I'm not foolish, I'm not totally ignorant about what this commitment is that I'm making. I have some sort of understanding of what I am supposed to be promising when I make the promise, and I'm willing to make that promise, then that person becomes the right person to me.
And I continue to make them the right person by continuing to be committed to what marriage is about.
Yes, exactly.
You know, what was really amazing to me, or I was really struck by it when I got married, was I thought when I got married, this is a really silly thing, but I kind of thought maybe I wouldn't be attracted to anybody else, or that would just be kind of the settled situation for me. And it was really surprising to me, I know again this sounds silly, that I really was attracted to other people, that there were a lot of other people out there that were closer to me in my interests or my size, or were even more attractive to me in a variety of different ways. And yet, the reality is, I had made a commitment to be married to Larry, not to any of those other people. And so being married means not that, again, this person has won the contest in all these areas, but that I'm continuing to to commit myself to them over and over again, even when there could be some other people that would fill my emotional, sexual, spiritual needs and in ways that might even be more fulfilling to me. What I'm doing here is I'm deciding to grow up, deciding to trust God in the context of my relationship with Larry.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me that you were surprised by that, because our mythology, the mythology of our culture is that when you have found the right person, you will be so absorbed in them that you won't even notice anybody else. They will meet your every need and fulfill your every desire so completely and so thoroughly that no one else will even be of notice to you. And it comes as a surprise to a lot of people that... I think there are divorces that happen because men and women wake up one day and go, wow, they're not meeting my every desire and being everything to me, and I'm not all absorbed in them. I must have married the wrong person.
Yes.
What a fool I was. I married too soon if I had only waited for the right person. But that's complete fiction. I mean, that's fairy tales. That no one in the world can meet my every desire. No one in the world can make me that absorbed in them.
But Jack, you know, when we're quasi-married... and we're in that kind of very intense, entitled relationship. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It feels that way. It feels like you intensely meet my every desire. If I'm involved emotionally with this person to a very strong extent, and again, if there is a sexual component, even though I feel that's very wrong, as is a very unbalanced emotional component, but if I'm very, very involved with them, then I have this intense sense of satisfaction that I've really got it. And if I marry in the midst of that, wow, watch out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've not committed myself to the kind of marriage that God talks about in the Scripture.
Exactly.
Over the years, a lot of people have come through Mackenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is Mackenzie? It's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. The Mackenzie staff members have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowing the truth contained in the Bible. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The Scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of Mackenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about Mackenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. Then when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, The Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners, and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Or you might want to read Jack Crabtree's Believing Without Seeing, First Reflections on Thomas. In this article, Jack argues that doubting Thomas has received a bum rap. Thomas merely demanded the same evidence of God's resurrection that the other disciples had received. Jack states, in the unfolding of the historical events, Thomas and no one else explicitly articulates what evidence he requires in order to believe. Jack goes on to say that this story highlights the extraordinary hurdle that exists for most people for people like you and me to come to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Then he personally concludes, "I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, most importantly, because it makes so much sense in the light of everything I have come to understand and know about myself, about God, and about life in general." Again, at the end of the program, we'll give you information on how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center.
In this last hour, we've talked about how do you get to know someone of the opposite sex while you're a single person. We've really focused on an age group that's 20 and older, approximately, not really talking about adolescents who are in relationships with each other. One of the main things that we were talking about was if we're in a relationship where I am feeling entitled to or like I own your time, your space, your commitment to me, then I'm really in a quasi-marital relationship, and that's wrong. I should only be in a marriage relationship when I've truly made with my mind clear a commitment of marriage. Apart from that, I'm not married, and I need to not act as though I'm married. What that does for me, though, I think that the psychology behind it is if I'm kind of in a quasi-marriage relationship, then I'm kind of taking out the risk of somebody rejecting me. And I'm giving myself, on the offensive, an opportunity to be really connected to another person and have my emotional need for not being lonely, for being connected to another person met. I am not then trusting God for my emotional needs. What I'm doing is I'm trying to take the risk out of my life so that I feel good rather than possibly face into some kind of deprivation that I might have to if I'm not deeply connected to another person and kind of owning them, feeling like, you know, I'm not going to have to live without them or spend an evening alone.
And I think that what we were trying to propose instead was forging the sort of friendships toward members of the opposite sex where I really commit myself to doing right by them. I mean, looking out for their best interests, being good to them, trying to be someone who will encourage them toward growing and developing in their relationship to God and in their obedience to God and so on. That's the firmest and surest foundation for any future marriage anyway. You described your own experience and how Larry got to know you and supported you and was a good friend to you. And that became a very, very solid foundation for your eventual marriage. Much better foundation than the sort of thing that we could ever hope to lay down in a so-called dating relationship.
And lastly, we talked about how do you decide who to marry? And you were saying, Jack, that we don't decide who we're going to marry by, you know, figuring out who the very best person in the world is. God actually does have a person that he chooses for us. But what I need to do is ask myself the question, can I be a loving person toward this other person? Can I be married to them in a kind of commitment that God is asking of a married person? If I can say yes to that, then yes, this is a person I should and can marry. And I work out all the obstacles of marriage throughout the rest of my life.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.